police, and American City. California sued, saying the president exceeded his power under a law that allows him to use troops against a rebellion, and also that the troops aren't needed. A judge declined to immediately block the troops from some duties, but scheduled a hearing for tomorrow. So, what is the purpose of this deployment? We called Tricia McLaughlin, who's an assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, which includes immigration enforcement. We spoke early Tuesday, LA time, so this reflects events on the ground up to then. How is the administration using the National Guard?
A lot of different ways, Steve.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the last few weeks, we have been speaking to a number of different legislators from here in southeastern Wisconsin. Today, I'm very happy to be connecting with Representative Greta Neubauer, who represents the 66th Assembly District for the state of Wisconsin. And in the interest of full disclosure, I want everybody to know that I know Greta Neubauer and her parents on a very personal level, but I don't want that to unduly interfere with the conversation that we will be having and the questions and answers that will be exchanged on some really important issues related to the state of Wisconsin, in particular, the budget impasse in which we all find ourselves at the moment. Representative Neubauer, thank you so much for joining me to the morning show. Thank you for making time for this conversation.
Yes, I'm so glad to be here, and I'm happy to hear you won't be asking me about my vocal range on the show.
No, not today. Not today. I happen to know quite a lot about your own personal background, your family, and so on, but some of our listeners might not necessarily understand exactly where you come from and also the way in which the work you are doing as a state legislator is, in a sense, a bit of a family affair. So tell our listeners whatever you think it would be good for them to know about your background and kind of the road that has ultimately led you to elected office.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for the question. And again, really wonderful to join you this morning. So I am born and raised in Racine. My family has been here for quite a few generations. And I grew up in the city, and I grew up around politics. My parents actually met in the state capitol, the building where I now work, and they raised me talking about politics at the dinner table. I started knocking on doors for candidates at a pretty young age, and really my first political involvement was Barack Obama's primary and first campaign for president. I was doing work here in Racine. I went down to Iowa for the caucuses. I was all in. And, of course, that was a really formative campaign to be part of the frame of hope and change and the vision that the president had for this country. After he was elected, I struggled a bit with what he either was not willing or able to do. And that pushed me into doing social movement work for a number of years, recognizing that we needed to have people inside and outside Capitol buildings who were supporting and pushing elected officials to do the right thing. And so I did work on the issues of climate with young people for a number of years during and after college. And then when Donald Trump was elected the first time, I recognized how critical Wisconsin is in the American political story and our trajectory, and decided it was time to do more local work in Wisconsin again, worked in the Capitol for a short time, and ran for office in 2017, end of 2017. So I've been in office now for a number of years, representing formerly really the city of Racine, now Mount Pleasant, Sturtevant, Elmwood Park, as well as sort of the southern part of the city of Racine. It has been, of course, an incredible honor. As I mentioned, my family is from the area, and I know and love this community and have seen our challenges, but also our great potential as we move into the future. And it's such a wonderful community to be part of and to be able to represent up in Madison. Mm-hmm.
I remember not long after your election, as I recall, that was a kind of a special election in that Corey Mason stepped out of the state legislature to become mayor of Racine. And so you were the victor in that special election to fill his seat. And your face was one of a number of faces that adorned a certain issue of Time magazine. For any of our listeners who don't recall that or didn't have the chance to see that magazine cover, explain what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so I was elected in the end of 2017, was the primary, beginning of 2018 was the Dunn roll. And during that time, that was, of course, not long after President Trump was elected for the first time, and there was a wave of particularly women who were stepping up to run for office. And so Time magazine published a story, and it was called, I believe, The Avengers, and it had the faces of all of these women who were running for office at that time, and my face happened to be in the E of Time on that cover, which was, of course, a huge honor to be pictured alongside all of those amazing candidates.
Very good. It occurs to me, as I think about you stepping into Corey Mason's legislative seat, that in some respects, he as mayor is able to capitalize on his experience in the state legislature in much the same way as former Kenosha mayor John Antaramian was also able to do that. I mean, his experience in Madison certainly has proved to be a huge help to him as mayor of Kenosha. And it just kind of underscores the importance of us being able to draw from various kinds of experience in order to do the job well. And of course, for you, as you just touched on, the fact that you are from a family that has had rich involvement in political life here in Wisconsin, that serves you very, very well as a young legislator in Madison, I should think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely think that's part of what informs my ability to do my work. I'm very lucky to have had pretty deep experience on the political side, campaign work as a young person, and then, as I mentioned, also on the organizing side, understanding how we work with stakeholders and partners to build public support for the issues that we care about. And when I ran for the first time, it was a tough time in Wisconsin as far as progressives would characterize it. So we had a conservative court. We had Scott Walker as governor. We had big majorities in the legislature of Republicans, primarily due to the gerrymander. And so I recognized that there was a huge amount of work that needed to be done and that we had an opportunity to methodically work to pick up more wins and to move our state in the right direction and then hopefully to win fair maps that would allow us to have an opportunity to actually govern in Wisconsin and to have the people of this state really decide who their elected officials are. And so I feel really grateful to be able to contribute those skills in this critical moment in Wisconsin. I certainly think that, you know, having this pretty deep political experience was part of what helped me be elected leader at age 30 and led to my colleagues trusting me to serve as the Democratic leader, minority leader, not too long after I was elected.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with State Representative Greta Neubauer. She represents the 66th Assembly District, and we are speaking actually Tuesday morning. This is airing Wednesday morning. We are speaking actually Tuesday morning as the state finds itself in a budgetary deadlock, if you will. I wonder if you would describe this impasse from your perspective and what you see in terms of a possible path forward.
Sure. So just a little context for folks who might not be following this quite so closely. I did serve on the Joint Finance Committee a few years ago, so as part of this process. And for the last several budget cycles, the Joint Finance Committee, the state's budget writing committee, meets really over the course of May and early June to discuss, debate, vote on various aspects of the state budget before sending that to the full Assembly and Senate for a vote, and then the governor for his signature veto or line item vetoes. We are moving slowly this year. The Joint Finance Committee really just started meeting, and negotiations between the governor and the Republican leaders broke down publicly last week. The governor, of course, put out a really strong budget earlier this year. This budget was focused on investing in education, in lowering costs for working families. These are the issues we heard about from people on the campaign trail and we continue to hear about in our communities. The governor was putting forward a level of investment in the conversations that he had with Republican leaders that is needed, specifically in our K-12 schools for the UW system and childcare. These are all areas, of course, that will, lack of investment here will have huge ramifications for our state. The childcare industry is in a crisis. They're hanging on. Thanks to federal funds that the governor was able to allocate in recent years, but those are running out soon. Our K-12 systems, of course, really struggling to provide adequate educations to our kids because of a lack of state funding. In this area, of course, we've had several referendums. Kenosha's failed earlier this year. Racine's passed, but schools are struggling. And then the UW system has been starved of resources. We are, I believe, now 44th in the country for funding from the state, and that is having real impacts on those students' ability to get the education they need to start life on a strong footing and have a good career. So the negotiations broke down around Republicans not being willing to make what I would describe as adequate investments in those key areas, which of course their constituents want too. But much like the federal level, they are focused first and foremost on tax cuts. And I don't think that lines up with what the people of Wisconsin are asking us for, but they are following in the footsteps of Donald Trump, and they are looking for ways to cut spending on services and programs that people rely on and put that money into tax cuts. And I hope that we are able to find a path here as we move forward. We're certainly still very much in this process, and there's still time for our Republican colleagues to come back to the table and work with us and work with the governor. But we will not be supporting a budget that doesn't make those necessary investments in education and lower costs for families across the state.
At this moment, are there meaningful conversations going on between the two sides of this divide? I mean, even informally, even in the hallways and so on, or is this an impasse in which very little in the way of meaningful communication is occurring? I mean, at least at this moment in time.
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say at some point to get a good budget, we will need to re-enter sort of formal negotiations, right, with leadership in the legislature, hopefully our Democratic caucuses and the governor, because that's where we can make big decisions about the kind of investments that we're going to make in this budget. But I will say that our members are always in conversation with Republican members. There have been ongoing conversations about issues ranging from childcare to housing to postpartum Medicaid expansion this year between our members and members of the Republican caucus. And, you know, something interesting is happening in the Capitol this year for the first time since I've been in office, which is that this is the first time we've had fair legislative maps. The numbers are a lot closer. Republicans have 54 members. We have 45 in the Assembly. We were at almost a super minority last time. And that means that there are more people who want to talk and get bipartisan work done. And there has been a shift. We haven't exactly seen that get the kind of policy we want across the finish line, but there are many more conversations happening than have happened in the past. And frankly, there are a lot of people, Democrats and Republicans, in the state capitol right now who have to go home and answer for this state budget. And they have to explain to their constituents why the things that they talked about on the campaign trail did or did not happen. And so I am hopeful that we're going to have a more productive legislative session because we just have a more representative legislature than we've had in the past.
Hmm. One more quick question along this line. I don't know if you saw the news release from something called the McIver Institute, which is a conservative group that is calling for a adjustment in the state budget process itself. I mean, calling for reform of the budget process itself, how the process, state budget, comes together. We don't have to go into the specifics of their proposal, but I wonder if you feel like there is any merit in thinking about the state budget process as it is currently put together, and if it is worthwhile to consider the possibility of making some changes.
I haven't seen this proposal from the McIver Institute. I suspect, given some of the proposals that they have put forward in the past, that I would take some issue with it. You know, I think we've all got thoughts about how to make this process more representative. The Joint Finance Committee does travel around the state and listen to the public, but they go to four places, and you generally have to show up at about 6 a.m. to sign up to testify and wait many hours in order to do so, of course, putting this out of reach for many people who can't drive across the state and take an entire day off of work or, you know, leave their kids at home. So I think there's certainly more that we can do to have the public be involved in this process. We saw issues really rise to the top there around investments in childcare and education, as I mentioned, healthcare, lowering costs, and ensuring we have stable, safe places for our grandparents to go live. So I would love to see a more direct correlation between what the public raises and what the Joint Finance Committee discusses. That's certainly something we hope to do when we're in the majority. But I do think overall this process is pretty functional. There's a role for the legislature. There's a role for the governor. We go back and forth. We each have an opportunity to have our say, and we will see how it works out.
Hmm. We're speaking with Greta Neubauer. She is state representative for the 66th Assembly District and Assembly Democratic leader, so minority leader. And, of course, there is more to your life as a legislator than just the state budget, although that, of course, I should think takes precedent at the moment. It really is, of course, of primary concern to you and your Republican colleagues as well. What would be some other priorities for Assembly Democrats at the moment, the issues that are of primary concern for you and the bills that you hope can perhaps be passed?
Sure. So as you mentioned, right now we're quite focused on the state budget, but then we will go on to have almost a year of additional legislative session where we will hopefully pass good bills that improve people's lives. When I'm out in the community holding listening sessions or office hours or just running into people in Racine County, I consistently hear about the economy. We, of course, have some new opportunities coming to our region, but we also are part of the state that was hit really hard by deindustrialization and many of those good union jobs moving overseas. And so we continue to have challenges in our region with folks being able to have a good job, pays a living wage, they can save for retirement, hopefully send their kids off to college or to get the career training that they need. We know people are struggling with costs. That includes childcare and housing and prescription drugs. We put forward a number of bills early this session that would have addressed those issues. Less for RX package on prescription drugs, homestead tax credit expansion, which was for homeowners and renters to save money on their taxes. And then a bill that we really want to get done this year, which is healthy school meals for all. So this, of course, would provide free breakfast and lunch for students in every school in Wisconsin. That's important for those kids to be well-fed so that they can learn and pay attention, but it's also important for families. Average family in Wisconsin with two kids would save about $1,800 a year if we passed that bill. And of course, grocery costs are a tough area for the state legislature to tackle, but this is a way to get at that issue. Democrats have also put forward some other bill packages than last month, our equality agenda. We know that the Trump administration is doing everything they can to attack the LGBTQ community at this time. We believe Wisconsin should be a place where everyone is safe and welcome. And just last week, we put out the Safe Summer package, which is gun violence prevention bills. These are common sense policies that Wisconsinites are asking for to reduce gun violence in our state. So we have a lot of work to do. Our interests span many issues, but we have a fantastic caucus of 45 members in the Assembly Democrats who are working really hard to craft good bills that we will try to get passed now. And we know once we have that Democratic trifecta, hopefully next year, we will pass a lot of these things into law and improve people's lives in our state.
One reality that you and your colleagues are having to deal with right now is what's occurring at the federal level and the way in which certain federal actions, federal policies are changing, many of them dramatically and many of them, in a sense, abruptly, which is not in and of itself to call them into question, but the fact that it is a situation changing quickly and dramatically, mm-hmm. and you and your colleagues have a lot to respond to, in a sense. What have been the most significant actions at the federal level that, in your mind, have called for some kind of response on the state level, and what kind of meaningful response is possible?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, of course, there are things going on at the federal level that Wisconsinites are very worried about. And probably at the top of that list for most folks are threats to Medicaid and Social Security, Veterans Administration. We have seen our Medicaid director, I believe, projected that 63,000 people would be impacted by the Medicaid changes that are currently being debated in Washington. And Republicans will say that these aren't cuts, that these are changes to the program, but I'm not sure those 63,000 people who could lose access to health care would agree with that. And when I'm out talking to people in our community, I don't hear people say, I don't want my neighbor to lose their access to health care, right? They want us to be focused on policies that improve everyone's lives here in Wisconsin and give everybody a little bit of breathing room. So we in the state legislature are doing our best to prepare for what could be coming from the federal level in this big bad bill. We know that SNAP cuts, food assistance is on the table, as well as Medicaid and other critical programs. What we're talking about here is potentially needy children and families not having access to what they need to get nutrition and a healthy meal at each day. So we are taking that into consideration in the state budget and hoping and putting pressure on our Republican colleagues to make sure that we are in a position to try to help fill some of those gaps if they should arise. Now, Wisconsin gets a lot of support from the federal government. And so if they make the kind of cuts that they're talking about making in Washington with Trump's bill, it's going to be really, really hard for the state to fill those gaps. We don't have the ability to borrow in the way that they do at the federal government, and so we will be in a crunch. We're thinking about that in the state budget process. And then we also just put out a package of bills called the Protect Wisconsinites package, and there were four bills included in this package. Two of them were ways that we can hold back some dollars that we send to the federal government if they withhold dollars that have been congressionally allocated to the state of Wisconsin. So if they illegally hold back money that the state of Wisconsin is expecting, we have a tool to hold back some of the money that we send to the federal government. We also have a bill about a private right of action if people's civil rights are violated, giving them some more tools for legal action. And then a fourth bill that's about data privacy and trying to make sure that Wisconsinites are able to be confident. We've seen, of course, Elon Musk mucking around in our private data, and a lot of folks very worried about that. We have only so much we can do at the state level, but we're doing everything we can. And, you know, in areas like southeastern Wisconsin, where we have a Republican congressional member, I and many of my Democratic colleagues in the Assembly are doing what we can to make sure that Brian Steil knows how we feel. You, like I, may have gotten some pieces in the mail from Brian Steil saying he's not going to cut health care. Well, we need to make sure that he knows we're paying attention to his votes on this big bad bill and that we are active, showing up at his office like many do in Racine on Monday mornings and telling him what we think and how we want him to represent us, that we don't just want him to go along with Trump's latest idea. So that's a big part of our work as well. It's not generally what people think about when they consider state legislators. But we know in this moment, with the real threats to our democracy and our rights and our well-being, that it is incumbent on us as leaders in our communities to do what we can to protect our constituents. Hmm.
One last quick question. I've done several interviews over the last few months that have been around the topic of, I guess you could say, bipartisanship and the possibility of political parties very much at odds with one another being able to work together. And more than one of these guests who've written on the topic have basically said that behind closed doors, there is more agreement than many of us would ever imagine. But that because of the climate in which we are in, the public stance of each party must be in very, very sharp contrast to the party on the other side of the aisle. In other words, publicly, there is bitter division. Behind closed doors, that division is not quite so serious. And I'm not, to whatever extent that's even true, I'm not even sure what that says. I mean, in terms of where that leaves us. But I wonder if you sense any truth in that when you think about your colleagues on the other side in the Republican Party. And if there is the potential for common ground, even if that is common ground that to some extent is beneath the surface at this moment.
Yes, I absolutely think that there is potential for common ground. And, you know, local issues will come up in this area, and I will speak to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, right? We'll go to a funeral for a leader in our community and do a joint commendation for that person who's passed away. And we discuss bigger issues at times as well. I mean, as you said, we did see negotiations happening between the governor and Republican leaders. They've stopped for now, but I think they might be back. I think we might be in those rooms with our Republican colleagues at the assembly level as well at some point. And I think what's key to all of this is that we have a functioning democracy. So when people are held accountable to their constituents, when elected officials are running on fairer maps, my district included, I used to have a very blue district. Now it's pretty purple. And that means that I have to work hard to make sure that I'm listening to my constituents and reflecting their perspective up in Madison. And so I hope that in the years to come, we continue to invest in our democracy. We make sure that it's easy and accessible for eligible voters to cast their ballot, that we have fair maps at the state and federal level, that people are able to engage in this process, make their opinions known, and hold their legislators accountable, because that is what pushes elected officials to work together and to put aside partisanship to get things done for the people they represent.
Greta Neubauer is state representative for the 66th Assembly District and Assembly Democratic leader. Greta Neubauer, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was great to speak with you. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg.
You're listening to The Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing an excerpt from an interview that we will be airing next week in its entirety. An interview with Roger Karp, responsible for a wonderful new book called Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, which tells the story of Lionel model trains through both text and photographs. And it is a book that is being released in honor of the 125th anniversary of Lionel Trains, and also being released in time for Father's Day. Here is a portion of my conversation with Roger Karp, talking about the incredibly rich legacy of photographs of Lionel Trains that inspired him to put this book together.
Well, Greg, I've been working for Classic Toy Trains magazine almost from the time it started. I've been with it since 1988, and over those years, I've been really lucky to be given access to a lot of personal photographs, photographs that had belonged to Lionel employees, and over the years, I'd collected them, and then I learned about photo archives and movie stills and publicity shots, so I had a really nice collection of photographs. When the pandemic came, I was looking for a new book project, and I challenged myself, could I write 400 words about each of these photographs? Could I do so in a way that would take it beyond the hobby and find some social and cultural significance in what the photo was showing in the relationship between, say, the child or the family or the celebrity who was using the train and the train itself? And my background as a PhD in American history really helped me tie these photos to larger currents in American life and see how these trains were influencing and reflecting the major values, the beliefs of our society.
You know, it's really true also that when you look carefully at these photographs, and in particular, when you look at the facial expression of these youngsters, you really see a very special sort of pride and energy and joy that is downright heartwarming. And I'm glad that you take the time to encourage us to look at these photographs with that kind of time and care, because if we fail to do that, then we fail to see some of what is here.
I agree, and that was really the fun of it, whether it's an ordinary family in the middle of America or whether it's Nat King Cole and his young son, that it's the relationship between the generations, which is why I really think my book is the perfect Father's Day gift. It will start conversations among the generations about favorite toys, trains, and what they meant. And that's why, to me, sometimes people will say, well, what is my old train worth? And I'll always say the sentimental value will always be greater than the monetary value. And I think, short of having the trains themselves, I believe these photographs can do exactly that. Get people talking, appreciating each other, and really link the generations. And that, to me, that's just so, so important.
Right. At one point you say, the more time spent looking at an old photograph showing toy trains, the more personal it becomes and entwined with your identity. An image taken long ago invariably sparks recollections of your childhood and the toys you loved. It nurtures memories of your own experiences with an electric train. The sights, sounds, and smells come back to life. You fasten on the warm memories revived by the vintage photo as vehicles to explore your past and reminisce about what you had. And I think that's all true. And I also want to just reiterate the fact that, you know, I, as someone who never got to own a toy train, model train, absolutely loved this book. And I think, you know, in that paragraph, you're touching on the fact that even if we're not reminded of toy trains in our own past, we are reminded of our own childhoods. I wonder if you could talk about the photography contest that was sponsored by Lionel, in which they actually encouraged people to take photographs of the model trains in their homes. Why they did that and what ended up happening? I mean, how many photographs ended up flooding into the Lionel corporate offices?
There were two photo contests that Lionel sponsored. One was in 1930, so again, right at the height of the Great Depression, and it asked kids to take pictures of their trains at home and submit them. And many, many entries were received. Unfortunately, I don't know that any have survived. Then again, in 1947, Lionel sponsored a contest at its central showroom in downtown Manhattan, and it invited anybody and everybody to bring their camera, come to the showroom, and take pictures on the large displays that Lionel had in its showroom. Thousands of people showed up, and many, many thousands of photographs were taken. I know of only one that has survived, and I show it in my book. I have to say, it breaks my heart. I would love to know what happened to all the others, because it would be such a wonderful snapshot of Lionel at its glory.
Right. There is a really interesting photograph in your book that actually was taken right around that same time as that first photography contest, 1930 or 1931, which of course, as you just said, was in the depths of the Depression when the Lionel Company was struggling mightily. And this is a photograph of a distinguished older gentleman with several young boys surrounding him. And this photograph captures a moment in which Lionel Trains received a very powerful and influential endorsement at a time when they were needing to do all that they could to stay afloat in those challenging times. Can you tell our listeners about this story?
Very much. Lionel took a new tack in its promotions during the 1930s. It would have, in this case, a railroad executive. Often it was locomotive engineers endorse Lionel Trains for their realism. And again, it was one more way, because Lionel was picking the people. Locomotive engineers were heroes to kids across America. So it was having those heroes say, hey, these trains are just like mine. Kids, this is what you really want to get. We want to ask mom and dad or Santa Claus to bring you. And it was a time when Lionel was pioneering the use of, say, a whistle in its steam engine, flashing lights. And then after World War II, the greatest innovation, smoke out of a smokestack.
Incredible. One of the other kinds of photographs that we see during in your book are four or five stills that are taken from various motion pictures, and this was a way also in which the wonder and fun of owning model trains was celebrated on quite a wide scale. And I wonder, maybe you could choose one or two of these films that included scenes with model trains and the difference that this would make in terms of helping to celebrate this.
The place to start is a movie from 1937 called Four's a Crowd with Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn. There was an older man in it. He's sort of a stuffed shirt, very distant, but his hobby is toy trains. And with Lionel's help, Warner Brothers built an extraordinary model railroad. I think it was 40 by 80 feet on a back lot in Hollywood. and we see scenes from it in the movie. It just fascinates us. But the trains were a way that this older man was made to seem more human, more approachable, more boyish. And at the same time, Errol Flynn could use the trains as a way to win his granddaughter. So that was one that really stands up. And there's another one, The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. It's a 1959 movie with Harry Belafonte, in which he thinks he is the last human being on Earth, having survived a nuclear blast. He ends up in an apartment in New York, and there is a Lionel train as well as a guitar. And so he has everything he needs to keep himself amused. And it just was fascinating to discover these movies, to see what the trains do. They played central roles in humanizing people, in showing the pleasures of life. And so that's always been just a fun thing to do, is find the movies with the trains.
Absolutely. As you've touched on already, there are various celebrities who engaged in this pastime to different degrees, and several of them are celebrated in your book, including a photograph in which we see the great Joe DiMaggio, one of the towering legends in Major League Baseball, playing with a model train. Tell us what we know about Joe DiMaggio, who ended up being on the cover of Model Builder magazine,
which was a Lionel publication. Joe DiMaggio fits the place, as was true with also Bill Russell of the Boston Celtics, the great celebrity whose family did not have the money to buy an electric train for him when he was a boy, but he remembered. And so once success came, Joe DiMaggio, like Bill Russell, bought a Lionel train. What made Joe DiMaggio even more important is that, like so many of the workers who built the Lionel trains at the company's factory in northern New Jersey, he or his parents had been born in Italy. So he was a hero, not just for being a great baseball player, but for his background to the workers at the factory. Joe DiMaggio would visit the factory, and he would just be mobbed. So to have him endorse those trains, to promote them, meant so much. And he, in turn, it gave him a chance to relax and just find a wonderful hobby. So that was so meaningful. The same way to get away from the bustling, hustling, bustling world was true with Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, who also made Lionel trains his passion.
Hmm. I want to give you a chance to talk about a photograph that is adorned with the headline, "I'll be home for Christmas, if only with my trains." And of course, that's a slight takeoff on a familiar Christmas song, and it touches on the reality of what it meant to be a soldier far from home anytime, but especially over the holidays. And this particular photograph is one of the most poignant in the book. Explain to our listeners what is in this photograph, what we are seeing, and its significance.
Glad to do so. This was a hard one to find and then to learn more about it. It's a picture taken right during World War II. It shows a number of soldiers who had been wounded overseas, I believe in North Africa. They have been brought back to the United States to a hospital in one of the boroughs of New York, maybe Staten Island, to recover. And while they are recovering and they know they're going to be sent back to combat, they have the opportunity to play with a large group of Lionel trains right underneath on the floor by a Christmas tree. And so, for many of these men, they may have never had an electric train before. Again, during the Depression, families probably couldn't afford them. And now that the war is raging, they certainly don't have the chance to play with them. So So this is, for many of them, a dream come true. And this, again, was a photo that I wanted to use to show these trains were more than toys. I mean, it seems silly to imagine these soldiers playing with roller skates or a wagon, those kind of toys. But when you put them with the electric trains, they seem boyish in the best sense. They seem relaxed. They can enjoy them and just really be themselves, be approachable, be normal, be the boy next door. It's the same reason that movie studios would pose Betty Grable or Rita Hayworth with Lionel trains to make them seem approachable, normal, and just someone you wanted to get to know.
You also tell us at one point, and when talking about women and Lionel trains, how women by and large preferred that these train cars be brightly colored, brightly painted, even though, of course, the typical train cars at the time, I mean, actual train cars were not necessarily painted in lively, bright colors, but at least many housewives and mothers, this was their preference in terms of what these model trains should look like. And is that advice that the Lionel Company followed to any serious extent?
It did indeed, because if you think about it, who is most likely to be buying the gifts for kids at a birthday or Christmas or Hanukkah? It turned out to be it was the moms, the aunts, the grandmothers. And so Lionel had to convince them that these were both beautiful toys, which it did by painting them in dazzling colors, rich browns, deep greens, beautiful blues, but also to convince them that these toys would enlighten their sons, their nephews, their grandsons, and help them become productive citizens, become better men. So together, aesthetically and, I guess, functionally, Lionel was using its trains to please women who would then buy them for their children, often boys, but a number of girls also got Lionel trains. And again, it was just to make them better. They had an educational aspect to them.
Roger Karp is senior editor at Classic Toy Trains magazine and the author of Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, A Photo History of an American Icon, published by Project Roar Publishing. We'll be airing this interview in its entirety next week. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kaylin Palomares pays her monthly visit to the program. And with her will be Judy Cardine, who is an educator with the Wisconsin DNR and part of their Bumblebee Brigade. It is a community science project in which ordinary people, ordinary citizens, can help participate in a program to chart the progress of bees in our natural environment and help restore their populations. We'll talk in particular about the rusty patch bumblebee and the efforts underway to try and restore its presence in the landscapes around us. We'll talk about the importance of bees, the dependence that we all have on bees for our well-being. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. And then on Friday, we're going to be hearing from some of the presenters of the upcoming event in Milwaukee, Trauma in Our Community, sponsored by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. The subtitle of the event, Reimagining Solutions for Healing. And we'll be talking to a couple of different presenters in the conference on Friday. The conference itself is occurring this coming Tuesday. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast calls for mostly sunny skies today and warm. High temperature in the low to mid 80s, perhaps even a little warmer out west. Overnight, clouds roll in and a good possibility of some showers and thunderstorms eventually developing. Overnight low of 59 degrees and actually a very good chance of rain over the next several days, Thursday, Friday, and into Saturday and Sunday. Looks like Thursday's high will only be in the mid-60s, warming up just a tad over the weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.